Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, Excellencies, members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, ladies and gentlemen, today in Afghanistan, a girl will be born. Her mother will hold her and feed her, comfort her, and care for her, just as any mother would anywhere in the world. In these most basic acts of human nature, humanity knows no division. But to be born a girl in today's Afghanistan is to begin life centuries away from the prosperity that one small part of humanity has achieved. It is to live under conditions that many of us in this hall would consider inhumane. So begins the lecture former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan gave to the Nobel Committee upon receiving the Centennial Nobel Peace Prize in 2001, nearly 20 years ago. Though, if we're being honest, not much has changed in the past 20 years, the past nearly fifth of a century. That Afghan girl he's talking about very well could have been born today. We have entered the third millennium through a gate of fire, Annan said, 3 months after the events of September 11th. But looking around now, maybe it wasn't just the gate that was on fire. It seems as though we have not learned our lesson, that hate begets hate, and violence begets violence, and division begets more division. Today, on the heels of yet another, I hate that word, another mass shooting within our borders, at the hands of homegrown white nationalist terrorism, that reality feels all too true. And yeah, I could stand up here and say something like, God is on the throne. But if I'm being honest with myself, that theological proclamation is starting to ring a little hollow. Because this, all of this, has been going on for a long time. Like, a long time. Longer than 20 years. And it all goes back, we see in our scriptures, to those pesky Baals. Now, those of you who are unfamiliar with intricacies of the foreign and domestic policies of the ancient divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah, and who are following along in your bulletin, are probably wondering what the heck is going on with that sermon title, Sacrificing to the Baals. Well, you all are in luck, because it just so happens that the intricacies of the foreign and domestic policies of the divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah are just the kind of things I like to geek out and nerd out over. I'm a real hoot at dinner parties. The long and short of it is that all of their troubles, all of the troubles of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, boil down to an economic system wherein wealthy landowners who live in urban centers bought up and rented out land in the rural areas. Those who rented and worked the land could never afford to own it for themselves. In part because the fruits of their labor, all of the fruits of their labor, went back to their landlords. It created a vicious and endless cycle of indebtedness and poverty, and the land being overworked and stripped of its nutrients, becoming less and less fertile with each passing year. And what, might you ask, were those wealthy landowning elites doing with all of that money, all of the fruits of their tenants' labor? They were doing everything in their power to secure their own status, their own power. They would pay massive tributes, lavish tributes, to foreign empires in the hopes that they would deal peacefully with them. Massive tributes that, more often than not, came in the sacrifices to the gods and idols known as Baals of the Assyrians and Babylonians, named after the Assyrian fertility god, Baal. The very empires that would eventually swallow them up and destroy their way of life. So, to recap, the ancient Israelite elite exploited their own people and used the results of their exploitation not to lift up the marginalized, but to secure their own status by making lavish sacrifices to a foreign fertility god whose empire would one day totally conquer their land and spread them throughout the Levant. We all on the same page? Exploitation, sacrifice, destruction. The fall of the two kingdoms posed a major problem of theology for the people of God at that time. Though we now understand the Abrahamic religions to be what we call radically monotheistic, that is, there is one God and there is only one God, this wasn't always the case. When we look at the texts written before the exiles, we don't find an outright denial of the existence of other gods. Take the first commandment, for example. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. Before me. It doesn't say, I am the Lord your God and I am the only God. No, it says, you shall have no other gods before me. Yeah, sure, there might be other gods out there, but I am your God. And I come first in your lives. It's what religious scholars today call henotheism, the worship of one God while not denying the existence, or even possible existence, of other lesser deities. And that lesser is an important distinction for us today. See, in those times, gods were intimately linked with their nation's identity. And the strength of a nation's god was directly proportional to the strength of the nation itself. If two nations went to war with one another, it was widely believed that the nation that won had the stronger god. And if your nation lost, or heaven forbid, was conquered, then your god wasn't all that great anyways, so you might as well start worshiping something else, like those new gods that came. So yeah, when Israel and Judah fell to the Assyrians and the Babylonians respectively, they had a bit of a religious crisis on their hands. If Israel and Judah fell, and their land was occupied, and their people dispersed throughout the entire ancient Near East, and the temple, God's very own dwelling place, was destroyed, then that must have meant that the God they worshipped, the God of Abraham and their ancestors, was weaker than the gods of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and therefore less deserving of their worship and adoration. The loss of their land and power brought with it a loss of their religion too. And yet, it's also right around this time that we see a shift in the texts to a profession of that radical monotheism we're familiar with today. Adonai, the God of Abraham and their ancestors, was no longer seen as one God among many, or even the strongest gods among many, but rather the one and only God. The gods of the Assyrians and Babylonians, the Baals, were false gods. Their statues and idols were merely wood and stone. In short, you didn't take us over because our God is weaker than you. We're the ones who fell away from our God. We disobeyed the commandments. We neglected to care for the most marginalized people, the orphan, the widow, the immigrant. We stole their land and resources to pay tribute to foreign empires, to make sacrifices to their Baals. Tribute and sacrifice that we thought would protect us, protect our status, protect our power, protect our privilege. And if protecting ourselves meant stealing from our children and our elderly and our impoverished citizens, the very people our God commanded us to protect, well then so be it. Your gods didn't defeat our God. Our God used you to punish us for our transgressions. And you know, I have to say, as far as theological judo goes, that's an outstanding move. It's the kind of move that allows a religion to not only survive, but flourish while the community is in the wilderness of exile, waiting for the day when God will settle them in their homes. Now, before I continue, I have to make a quick pastoral distinction. I want you to note the conditions and context from whence this theology emerges. The community from which it comes is living through and reflecting upon their own experiences, their own trauma. It's not coming from a place of comfort and ease toward another person. They're trying to make sense of their own trauma. See, the challenge with this kind of theological reasoning, that suffering is the result of God's divine retribution for our transgressions, is that it's really easy to, even with the best of intentions, externalize and push that theology on others, living through their own traumatic experiences. It's one thing for me to say to myself, "The Lord is testing me," or "I screwed up." It's quite another altogether for me to say to someone else, "The Lord is testing you." Or, "You know, this is really your fault." Especially when I have more power and privilege than that someone else. And to be perfectly clear, that line of thought isn't totally universal in the prophetic text either. In some places, sure, God's judgment is painted as swift, a God who is leading the armies of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. But in other places, we see a more nuanced approach from the prophets. In our chapter from Hosea this morning, Hosea doesn't paint a picture of God who is destroying Israel God's self. On the contrary, in this chapter, Hosea paints a picture of God who laments, who grieves, who mourns God's children's infidelity. "The more I called them, the further they went from me. How could I hand you over, Israel? How can I make you like Admah or treat you like Zeboim, those two cities in the plain of Sodom and Gomorrah?" What Hosea tells us is that none of this, any of this, is what God desires. None of this brings God any joy. My heart winces within me. My heart winces within me. It's a cry that reverberates through time and space, because if we're being honest, those Baals haven't really gone away, have they? Sure, Assyria was eventually destroyed. And for that matter, so were the Babylonians. Their Baals and other idols reduced to rubble, or if they're lucky, sitting in a museum somewhere. But their lure has persisted through the ages and persists still today, using different names, different slogans, different structures. White supremacy. Christian nationalism. America first. Privatized prisons. Colonialism. Nuclear proliferation, because pulling out of a nuclear treaty, literally the week before we remember the anniversary of dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is par for the course, I guess. Militarized police forces, sexism, heteronormativity, the NRA, thoughts and prayers, capitalism run amok, border security, national security, the military-industrial complex, profit that comes from destroying our planet, profit that comes from destroying lives, patriarchy, every single time, we try to protect ourselves and preserve our own institutions at the expense of others, all Baals, every last one of them. We pay tribute to them. We bow down and we worship them. We make sacrifices to them. The lives of our children and our children's children and our children's children's children. We think that if we just make one more sacrifice or say one more prayer to these false gods, then everything will be made right in the world, without us having to do anything to change on our parts, without realizing that the sacrifices we're making and the tributes we're paying are costing us everything, are costing us the lives of the very people we are called to protect and care for. And if we continue down this road, we can expect the same fate as those who came before us. Swords striking wildly in our cities, consuming our gates, and taking away everything we hold dear. But there's another way. Each of us, Kofi Annan says, has the right to take pride in our particular faith or heritage. But the notion that what is ours is necessarily in conflict with what is theirs is both false and dangerous. It has resulted in endless enmity and conflict, leading men to commit the greatest of crimes in the name of a higher power. It need not be so, he continues. We can love what we are without hating what and who we are not. We can love what we are without hating what we are not. We can hear the voice of God roaring out like a lioness and return to her like her cubs. We can turn away from the Baal's enticing lure and realign our lives with what God desires for us, all of us, each and every one of us, rich and poor, free and fettered, privileged and humiliated. And that might mean giving up our own power. It might mean letting go of our own privilege to stand alongside those who are most marginalized. Or it might mean using our power to be co-creators with God of God's justice, using our power to dismantle the very systems and structures that privilege certain people over others. Both can be true. Both have to be true. Your Majesties, Excellencies, Ladies, and gentlemen, you will recall that I began my address with a reference to the girl born in Afghanistan today. Even though her mother will do all in her power to protect and sustain her, there is a 1 in 4 risk that she will not live to see her 5th birthday. Whether she does is just one test of our common humanity, of our belief in our individual responsibility for fellow men and women. But it is the only test that matters. May it be so. Amen.